Hello, Avril Danchak here. Welcome to Teaching and Learning Consultation Skills, Module 12, Managing Uncertainty in the Consultation, taking a deep dive into all aspects of uncertainty so that clinicians can manage it better and in less stressful ways. Hello, this podcast will explore some of the skills needed to resolve what you do and you don't know what to do moments in the negotiating quadrant. This is the situation where the diagnosis is known and one clinician is trying to negotiate an effective way forwards with one patient, while sometimes being uncertain. Being able to smoothly negotiate a management plan which is both medically sensible and also practically feasible for the patient is no mean feat. Many clinicians spend so much time on initial information gathering part of the interview that the second half of the consultation is relatively neglected. When explaining works well, the clinician remains focused on the patient, engaged on dialogue rather than instruction, and is able to incorporate the patient's own thoughts and feelings into the discussion. The plan is then truly shared. Part of the problem can be that not all patients want to be involved in decision making to the same degree. People want different amounts of information and may understand it in different ways. We often assume that we have to reach a final plan in a single consultation, especially in secondary care where it may not be possible to see the patient again. This may be too ambitious, yet sometimes the skills needed to manage decision making in a more timely fashion are lacking. This can work both ways. A woman who has thought hard about her problems, read things up on the internet, talk things over with her GP and her family, may be ready to make a decision about having a hysterectomy at her first clinic visit and may resent being told to go away and think it over. The skills needed to resolve these kinds of issues are the subject of this podcast and include explaining and negotiating skills. We're going to be talking about risk and shared decision making with Dr. Roy Walworth in a subsequent podcast. Something about the common behaviour called why don't you, yes but. Something about how we can help people change their behaviour, how we can engage with complex problems and manage non-medical problems. If you're reaching an impasse in the negotiating quadrant when you're trying to work out the best way forwards and not getting anywhere, first think about your explanation. Was it good enough? Successful explanations share the clinical findings with the patient in a way that enables the clinician and the patient to move towards a shared understanding of what needs to happen next. Explanations must be adequate, relevant, understandable, and appropriate. And to do that, all explanations need to begin with a knowledge of where the patient is coming from already. What do they know or fear? What are they anticipating? What's really important to them? Listening for and acting on what the patient is communicating about their life world leads to improved dialogue and more effective planning of care. As Stephen Covey says, seek first to understand and then be understood. TALC modules 4 and 5 contain a series of useful skills to help you explain things more easily and to negotiate how to proceed, based on information gathered in TALC module 3 about the patient's own perspective, their thoughts, their concerns and their worries. An adequate explanation will cover the key findings and issues, and a relevant explanation will ensure that your explanation refers to the patient's own worries and concerns, even if those are different from the clinician's concerns or views. Easily understood explanations are free of jargon, technicalities and acronyms. They use short sentences with pauses where the patient is invited to respond. Communicating well means matching the style of the patient's language and the metaphors they use, and placing small words like if, but and when to helpful effect. Appropriate explanations must refer to the patient's own health beliefs, his own attitudes and values, and what's important to them. This means that explaining must necessarily be a dialogue, not a lecture, and should always include phrases such as, what's your own response to that? Or, what do you make of what I've been saying? Or, what questions have you got at this stage? Or, how did you come to be so worried about? Note that these are all open questions or statements. A closed question like, did you understand all that, will usually receive the answer yes, even if the patient is still mystified, as all too often patients don't like to challenge clinicians. If this part of the consultation is not going well, it's often because the clinician doesn't really understand the patient's point of view or is not taking it fully into account. Linking your explanation to what the patient is thinking about can often be enough to help things move on successfully. When the clinician and the patient agree on what needs to be done, there's usually no problem. But the what do you do and you don't know what to do situation can arise when the clinician has a plan but the patient is unwilling or unable to follow that plan or may not agree with the clinician's priorities at all. Sometimes the patient's wishes are unrealistic or not feasible. So being able to negotiate a win-win situation doesn't mean being manipulative, but uses the pragmatic and ethical considerations that you use in all consultations. Begin by understanding what the patient is thinking and clarify the issues at stake for them. Summarise this, and then summarise what you might be able to offer. Make sure you identify common ground. For example, we're both keen to make sure you enjoy your college course fully. And look for shared goals and common interests that will help to build the relationship with the patient and open up areas for discussion. Summarising a synthesis of what has been said will show that you've listened and understood, and this must be checked explicitly with the patient by asking a question such as, "What's your response to that so far?" There are often areas where you and the patient can find agreement, even if you disagree about other things. And finding these can create a positive framing for the discussion about things where you and the patient may not agree. Isolate the things that might be difficult and refer back to things that you have agreed to already. And remember that sometimes a less than ideal situation can be accepted if it means some progress can be made, even if the patient doesn't want to undertake all your treatment recommendations. For example, they may not wish to give up smoking. Don't stick too rigidly to your own point of view. You may need to change your direction a bit to help the patient move to his own reasonable and important goals. Some discussions in the negotiating quadrant can be made more difficult if there's more than one person consulting, for example, a parent and child, or a couple, or a spouse, or sometimes even friends. And TALC Module 10 has a whole chapter on the skills that will make this kind of discussion a lot more smooth. When negotiating with patients, it's always good to be creative and flexible. Guidelines are not tramlines. It's appropriate and necessary to tailor things to the individual with flexible solutions. This may mean using lower doses of medication than is conventional if patients find that helpful. It may mean using different combinations of tablets in unusual ways that may be more acceptable to the patient. When you're negotiating with a patient, you can harness their own beliefs and attitudes to help you negotiate a plan. It helps to consider whether the patient is being influenced by the past, this is what's always happened to me before, or the present, which may be about their constraints or priorities, or their concerns for the future. If I do this, what will happen? Use the perspective that the patient is most concerned with and explore their ideas about this overtly. If negotiations with patients are sometimes a bit sticky or difficult, then seek out more detailed information and perhaps more training. When talking to a patient about the best management plan, have you ever had a conversation that's been difficult? Something like this. "I want some help losing weight," says the patient. Clinician: "We have an excellent weight management clinic here." Patient: "Yes, but I can't get time off work during the day except when I have holidays." Clinician: "Well, we do have locally sponsored cheap rates for evening weight loss support groups." The patient says, "Yes, but I don't like going out at night." Clinician: "Well, I can recommend some excellent diet books and leaflets." Patient says, "Yes, but I can't afford to buy them and I'm not interested in reading them." This sort of thing can go on until the clinician gives up, and this allows the patient to take the view that the problem is really too difficult and they can't be expected to solve it. This is dysfunctional, although in an odd way quite satisfying for the patient, who's able to let go of the responsibility for dealing with the problem. If you want to understand the process more, read Games People Play by Eric Byrne. In the consultation, be aware of the "yes but" line from the patient. After they've said it once, stop making suggestions. Instead, inquire what kind of approaches did the patient have in mind instead? What did they think would be the best way forwards? This is the antidote, but does need to be applied calmly, kindly, and without trying to get one over on the patient. How do they see their health at this point? And what would they like help with? Sometimes hoping that patients will change behaviours that are adversely affecting their health can cause frustration or bad feelings between clinicians and patients and can give rise to the "what you do when you don't know what to do" moment. This is often about common issues like weight loss or smoking, and sometimes watching a patient you know well drinking themselves to death but still consulting about abnormal liver function tests can be very disturbing for clinicians. In this situation, the clinician needs to change their stance from that of a clinical director — your symptoms are caused by this and I'm going to tell you the effective treatment — to something a little bit more like a well-informed guide or a critical friend. The destination is being chosen by the patient, not the clinician, and this means a shift from telling to listening and understanding. To find out where the patient is coming from and listening for and using the patient's own motivations for change. There's quite a lot of practical training around about this sort of issue these days, and basically it consists of having open questions to understand the patient's position, listening for evidence of ambivalence or motivation, and first of all finding what they like about the behaviour which they might need to change. Why do they like smoking? What are the benefits of drinking for them? Affirming rather than opposing the patient's point of view, paradoxically, helps to keep the clinician alongside the patient rather than in opposition. Accepting and understanding the patient's current position is often the best way to initiate change and overcome resistance. Saying something like, "so stopping smoking feels like it would be overwhelmingly difficult just now, that kind of makes sense from what you've told me," can actually make the patient say, "yeah, but I think I could do it next month or after Christmas," or start to make some other kind of plan. Another simple way to open up a more productive discussion is to explore the patient's thoughts about change using decision scales. For example, saying something like, "on a scale of 1 to 10, how important is it for you to, for example, stop smoking?" And then asking them, "how did you choose that position? What would make it 0, in other words, not important at all? What would make it 1 or 2 grades more important than where you are at present?" These kind of discussions can be quite thought-provoking and certainly very enlightening for clinicians. This can be followed up saying, "how confident are you that you could make the change? What would make you less confident? What would make you more confident?" This helps to clarify motivation and blocks to change. If the motivation to change is low, does the patient see the future as being just the same? How do they see it if nothing changes? What could happen to make this change more important in the future? Many psychologists talk about reflection or rolling with resistance, which is also known as resisting the writing reflex. All clinicians tell people to stop smoking, but only a few people comply. It's often helpful to resist the reflex to tell the patient he has the wrong plan. Roll along with his plan and stay alongside. Agree with them. "Yes, I can see that smoking offers you regular breaks from your difficult boss at work." Show empathy to show that you really understand his position. "I can see it's more important to see your friend in the pub than it is to have better test results. So maybe changing your drinking habits just isn't so important to you right now." And then you can say, "is there anything that would make this a bit more important down the line so that we know when to discuss it again?" And that will open up discussion further. As in every aspect of the consultation, summarising the discussion you've had is an opportunity to build the relationship by showing the patient you've really understood their position, summarising any commitments they've made to small changes and any agreements that you've made about follow-up appointments and so on. Having conversations about behaviour change is rarely going to be a one-off event. building a supportive and positive relationship may require some time, and clinicians should make every effort to construct continuity in their care so that such a relationship can develop. When there is a good relationship, the patient is more likely to have motivation to change. It can be useful to have information about services such as smoking clinics to hand if there's a moment when the patient agrees that they'd like some more information. Clinicians often experience what you do when you don't know what to do moments when they're engaging with very complex problems. People who have multiple different illnesses, complicated life situations, and who may have language difficulties or learning difficulties or some other complicating social or economic factors. Managing these kinds of situations is sometimes easier for specialists who can say, "I will just deal with my system." Generalists, GPs in particular, who are faced with patients who have maybe 10 different conditions and maybe on 20 or more medications, can be forgiven for feeling a bit overwhelmed. Remember, the patient is probably feeling pretty overwhelmed too. And empathically noting this and positively connoting their ability to cope by saying something like, "You have a lot of different things to manage. Tell me how you cope with this day to day, because that's a lot to deal with," can sometimes build the relationship in a helpful way. Another initial step can be to make a mind map of the patient's issues, with the patient contributing. Draw a circle in the middle of the paper with the patient's name on. Draw lines out to circles representing the patient's problems, trying to put linked problems adjacent to each other. If the patient is taking a lot of drugs, then try and link each to the problem for which they're being taken. This could even be done with the patient not in the room, perhaps as part of the preparation for a complicated consultation. In discussion, use this information to generate the priorities for right now and for today. Remain calm, but also explain that it is unlikely that all the problems can be dealt with at once, even though they are all important. Furthermore, when mapping like this, some new connections may suggest themselves that may be overlooked. For example, grief over somebody's death may lead someone to eat more and become obese, which may make their anxiety and their diabetes worse. Some drug interactions can be highlighted. And for example, the common situation where the patient is taking several drugs merely to counteract the side effects of other drugs. Mapping this clearly can help both parties to feel less overwhelmed and offer a way to use future consultations effectively by going through the problems in groups. Continuity is crucial here to build a sound clinician-patient relationship and create the basis for effective decision-making. Getting to know each other well will facilitate trust and understanding for both parties. The clinical course of patients with complex comorbidities is rarely straightforward and will not be predictable in a linearly understandable way. Many, many different issues will interact to produce the outcome. At times, this may feel like chaos as uncertainty increases, and the degree of agreement between different people about what should be done can also increase. Acknowledging and perhaps even enjoying the uncertainty that such non-linearity brings can help to make such consultations more understandable and sometimes release some creativity and humour in the relationship. A very common situation that makes clinicians feel they don't know what to do is when the patient presents with problems which seem to be primarily or totally non-medical. This could be domestic problems, or work problems, or other areas over which the clinician has little influence. There is a lot of detail about how to deal with this in TALC Module 4, Do Non-Clinical Problems Take Up Your Clinic Time?, where the BATHE method is summarised. This is described fully in a very useful book called The 15-Minute Hour. Think of this as bathing the patient in empathy, thinking about the background with specific and empathic comments, asking how things are affecting the patient, again employing empathy and kindness, asking them what aspect is troubling them the most, because this helps to focus the conversation and mobilise action. Asking people how are they handling or how are they tackling their problems can also help people to focus on what they're doing already. Sometimes people say they simply feel overwhelmed, but acknowledging that that is the most troublesome thing can sometimes help with strategies like making a list or prioritising. The key thing is empathy. If they're very long-term problems, a technique called a positive bathe can be useful to direct the conversation, and there is more information about this in TALC Module 5. There is good evidence that focusing on positive emotions is beneficial for well-being. And the positive bathe goes something like this. What is the best thing that's happened this week? How did that feel? How can you account for that? How did it happen? What are you most grateful for at the moment, most thankful for? And how could you make these things happen more often or more regularly? These questions need to be combined with empathy and empowerment. Give positive regard to anything that has been achieved. It's great you've managed to stay at work in spite of the difficulties, for example. Or, I think the plan you've mentioned sounds really good. I'm sure you'll find a way to do it. With a relatively new patient, the bathe technique will work best. But if you're following up a patient for a long time or seeing him often with a chronic problem, try the positive bathe to promote empowerment and energy in the consultation. Positive psychology research clearly shows that positive feelings and experiences release endorphins for both clinician and patient, and this is good. Negative thoughts increase adrenaline, which can affect bodily function and psychological functioning adversely. On several occasions during these podcasts, we've used a word that some have come to dread, the word metacognition. This means thinking about your thinking. And applying metacognitions to the psychological issues between clinician and patient can also help to identify how things are going wrong when there's a what you do when you don't know what to do moment. Unconscious psychological processes in both sides may interfere with the smooth progress of a consultation. The clinician can help themselves by being self-aware. Take notice if something the patient says strikes a personal chord and seems irritating, unreasonable, or gets a disproportionate emotional reaction in yourself. This may mean there's something going on for you other than the surface meaning of the consultation. And here's an example. Dr. Hazel has recently coped with a serious illness in a very close family member, but didn't take any time off work. Things have got better now. When their patient comes in insisting on a sick note because my mother-in-law's sister is unwell, I'm too anxious to go to work, unconsciously, Dr. Hazel feels a bit resentful. After all, she herself coped with a very difficult situation without any time off work. Dr. Hazel says no to a sick note, rather than fully exploring what the patient is experiencing. This causes conflict. The patient gets angry, storms out, and immediately books an appointment with a more sympathetic colleague. I think we've all been in similar situations. The processes to be aware of include these. There's a process called transference, and this is when the patient behaves towards you as a clinician as they behave elsewhere. For example, someone who bullies their spouse may try to bully the doctor or the clinician. In contrast, countertransference is when the clinician behaves towards the patient as if the patient was someone else. So, the doctor who was bullied at school rolls over and bullies patients and is unnecessarily rigid. In contrast, the clinician who was bullied at home may simply roll over to bullying patients and try to give them everything they want to avoid trouble. Another interesting phenomenon is called projection, and this is when uncomfortable parts of your own self are projected into others. So, for example, the patient may not acknowledge his own helplessness or being overwhelmed, but project that feeling into the clinician, who in turn feels helpless and overwhelmed, as if they can't help the patient. Some things that patients experience are simply too painful to articulate. If being overweight makes you feel embarrassed and ashamed, you just may switch off whenever it's mentioned. Doctors and patients may both find certain subjects hard to talk about, such as domestic conflict or abuse, and they avoid the clues and cues that show its presence. Sometimes discussion with seniors or bailiff group type discussions is the best place to learn about these things. Being able to recognise the gut feeling that all is not well in the consultation must tell you that a metacognition is needed of some kind, a reflection on what's going on here, what is the experience, what do we need to do next. This ability to reflect in real time on what is going on is a key skill for all clinicians to develop. Knowing that you have to start a different thinking process creates more options, more room for manoeuvre, and may actually reduce clinicians' stress. In the scenario I described before, it would be better if the clinician made a conscious effort to put their own experience aside and try and understand their patient, Mr. Glass. Further exploration transpires that his family members are not well off. The sick lady has no children. He is the only one in the extended family with a car, and he feels that he should help out by taking his mother-in-law to see her sister in hospital. Although sympathetic, the clinician then asks about the possible impact such absences will have on his employer and his work. Mr. Glass confesses that he is on a second warning for taking unpredictable time off. So the clinician then is able to explain about financial help for bus fares to hospital and offers a short sit note so that the patient can sort things out in a more rational way without jeopardising his own employment. There are two further aspects to the negotiating quadrant which are important causes of difficulty. These are the difficulty in making truly shared decisions, especially in complex situations, and the other difficulty is in explaining risk and uncertainty to patients when they have to weigh up a series of options. These are going to be discussed with Dr. Roy Walworth in a following podcast. The importance of language in consultations and the ways in which this can ease the negotiation quadrant is going to be discussed with my colleague Dr. Mohan Kumar. So look out for these podcasts, which are of great interest. Thank you for listening to Talk 12 on managing uncertainty in consultations. Make sure to get all the episodes by subscribing to the Talk Talks podcast on Podbean or your other podcast provider. All the podcasts and the other teaching and learning consultation skills materials are available at consultationskills.com. Our book, Mapping Uncertainty in Medicine, What Do You Do When You Don't Know What to Do, by myself, Avril Danchak, Alison Lee and Geraldine Murphy, is available online and through all good bookshops.